First, one or two things just to introduce the city. And the word Philadelphia, of course, speaks to many of us of a city in America today. It was founded here in 140 BC. So, in fact, it was quite a new city as far as the world was concerned in those days. The guy who founded it, his name doesn't matter very much, but he was immensely kind to his brother, and he got a sort of nickname around the place called Brother Lover. I don't know what it is in the Greek, right? Well, I suppose it's Philadelphia, but they called him that, and when he founded the city, they called it Philadelphia. It's nothing to do with Christian brotherly love, although we might want it to be that. It's simply something that arises from this man, Attalus II, who founded the city. Now, one of the reasons he founded the city was this. He wanted a missionary base, but not for Christian mission, but for spreading Greek ideas in the world of his day. So he built this city on what was virtually called the gateway to the east, a strategic geographical position through which a lot of people would come as travelers with the hope that he could develop the ideas with them and they would take those ideas to other parts of the world. So it was a missionary city of a kind. And the letter to this church in Philadelphia is a letter of enormous encouragement. As I intimated at the beginning of the service today, it does seem to me that a letter written to a persecuted church, which this is, may be difficult for us to feel closely towards. But if you could transfer yourself now into a wood outside a Russian town with a group of Christians standing in the open, seeking not to be noticed by officials and guards, worshipping Jesus in the depths of this wood, this letter would be dynamic. It would be a tremendous encouragement to lay hold of. That's its context. And yes, as I said at the beginning, many people in this congregation are undergoing persecution, and very real persecution for Jesus. And I hope that you will take this letter. And who knows what lies ahead, even in this country. Will there be persecution? There may well be persecution for the faith. And let's treasure, therefore, this letter as we look at it together this morning. The church was small, verse 8 intimates that. It was a church of little power. But it was an excellent church. Notice that, compared with all the other letters, there is no criticism at all. No heresy, no inter-party strife. The enemies of this little church in Philadelphia were all the enemies from outside, rather than from within. Of course, persecution cleanses the church to some extent. Its internal factions soon fade into insignificance when you're under persecution from outside, don't they? So in some sense, we can understand that. Nonetheless, this church is commended for its standard as a church. So it is a letter to every persecuted church in the world of today or at any time. Now, how does Jesus encourage them? I want to suggest the three things that come up in this epistle, in this letter, that are of immense encouragement. First, Jesus reminds them in verse 7 of who he is. And it's to this point that all of us who belong to Jesus need to return frequently to who Jesus is. Once we lose that perspective of Jesus as Lord and God, then everything else gets out of perspective, doesn't it? See the titles that are used here, and there are three of them. First, that he is holy. Now that means, in this context, that he is God. Not just a man or a prophet, but God. The person who said, all power is given unto me in heaven and on earth. And this title of God is something we need to reassert as we think of Jesus as the head of the church. And they had to feel it there in Philadelphia as the powers of Antichrist attacked the church with severe and bitter persecution. Many people have had to feel it as the powers of Antichrist have swept through their nations. The Christian church in Iran has known this within the last 2 years in a bitter way. The church in that situation has to lay hold of the fact that whatever the enemies of Jesus may do, he is God. They may obliterate all the followers of Jesus, but they cannot obliterate him. His kingdom stands forever. He is the Lord. So it's natural, and Ruth reminded us of this in her prayers this morning, that when the church undergoes persecution right at the beginning in Acts 4, they came together to pray. And you remember that they prayed like this: Sovereign Lord, Acts 4, who made heaven and the earth and the sea and everything in them. First, yes, God, this is your world. And then they took hold of Psalm 2. Why did the Gentiles rage and the peoples imagine vain things? The kings of the earth set themselves in array, and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his anointed. Psalm 2, that enormous strength to the early Christians, that Jesus was king, and all the nations of the world are his heritage. So lay hold of the fact that he is God, and you're going through suffering. You're facing cancer. Perhaps knowing that that cancer is, humanly speaking, going to be fatal. Perhaps some constant burden in your life, physical or mental, that you have to put up with. And in the midst of it all, you have to come back and back and back to say, yes, but he is God. We need to do this in the world turmoil in which we share at the present time. And yesterday, when the Parochial Church Council was away in its day conference, Shirley Montgomery opened the day for us with the passage we actually had planned to read for the first lesson this morning, Isaiah 40. Before we would start yesterday's discussions, we had to come back rightly to the center that he is God. Holy, true is the second title, you'll notice here, that Jesus reminds them about. Now, it doesn't mean simply that Jesus is the speaker of the truth. It's talking about, in the way the word is used here, the contrast. That is, that he is true compared with what is false. He is real compared with what is unreal, or shadowy, as it were. He is perfect compared with what is imperfect. This thought is something that runs, for instance, through John's Gospel. You remember that John says, John 1:9, that Jesus is the true light coming into the world. Lots of other lights around. There were the prophets before him, the forerunners, John the Baptist, and so on. But he is the true light. Everything else was only preparatory, and all other religions are only secondary. He is the true light coming into the world. Or John 6:32, he is the true bread from heaven. Or John 15:1, he is the true vine. Or Hebrews 8, verse 2, he is the true tabernacle. So the full flood of light came in Jesus Christ. And all that went before in the Jewish system of priest and tabernacle and all these ideas were but shadows of the reality that Jesus was to fulfill. Now, that was important to lay hold of because the attack, as you can see from these verses, was from the synagogue in Philadelphia. It was the Jews who were persecuting the Christians. It was the Jews who had brought this severe and bitter attack upon the little Christian church there in that city. And they would want to say that Jesus is simply a prophet. They would want to emphasize what are the shadows, the types, the priest and the tabernacle and these things, rather than the Messiah. And Jesus is saying to them, look, hold on to the fact. This is incontrovertible. I am the true one.
and all else was shadow and preparation for myself. We also, and down through the centuries it's been true of the Christian Church, need not to lose our nerve. Christ is the eternal Lord. And in the present day, when increasingly, not least in the scholastic system, we are moving towards the idea that all religions lead to God and Christianity is simply one of them, the Christian needs to stand out, even under persecution, for what we believe to be utterly true. You believe it, don't you? That Jesus is the only way to the Father, that no one comes to the Father but by him. We hear people, Christian ministers, leaders in the Christian church today, being quoted and writing books and making statements saying to other religions, well, we're all in the search together. That is blasphemy. If Jesus is God, and Jesus came into the world as the light of the world, there is no one to compare with him. We cannot level Jesus to being one amongst many or to the fact that we're all in a search for God. When Jesus came, the search was over. That's the message, isn't it, of the New Testament? What we looked for is now opened up in Jesus. We have the truth. And even though that is an uncomfortable word in an age that wants compromise, it is the only word that we can preach and teach. God has revealed himself in his word and supremely in Jesus. The truth has come, the way has been opened, the gate of glory is declared. Christ is the true one. And they needed that reasserting in their lives. The third title, you'll see, verse 8, is that he is the one who opens and shuts the kingdom. He has the key of David, it says. Now, Peter, we remember, was given the keys of heaven, but only as surrogate. Jesus holds the keys, and entrance into the kingdom does not depend on Peter, though sometimes some people would tell us it did, but on Christ. Revelation 1:18, of course, says, I, Jesus, have the keys of death and of Hades. Now, if Jesus holds the key, an entrance into the kingdom of God can only be through him. Then the Jews attacking the church in Philadelphia and the heathen worshippers rampant in that city were outside the kingdom. And it was not a moment for the church to retreat behind its ramparts and say, well, we're going to just live for a quiet life. We believe Jesus is God. We believe he's the Messiah. We believe all you lot are wrong. But we don't want trouble. We want anything for a quiet life. We just shut the doors and get on with it. But Christ challenges his church as the one who opens and shuts his kingdom, as the one who alone has the key. No church that is faithful to Jesus Christ can avoid the responsibility of evangelism. We are called to it. It's laid upon us, and any church that turns in for its own comfort and joy and celebration rather than from the outreach of the faith is going to shrivel and die. So Jesus reminds them of himself in these glorious ways. He is God. He is the true one. He alone holds the keys of the kingdom. What an encouragement to them to stand fast in the midst of persecution. Then as we go on in the letter, verse 8, we see a second way in which encouragement comes. And this is the encouragement that Jesus gives them in what he sees in the church in Philadelphia. Notice again in verse 8, I know your works. I want to underline the fact that this word works comes up in most of the letters. As I said a little while ago, and I'd like to underline it again this morning, some people take John 14:12, he who believes in me will also do the works that I do, and greater works than these will he do, because I go to the Father, as a charter for constant miracles in the church. Now, whatever the place or otherwise of miracles, and that's a different subject, and we've preached on it and shared it together,
John 14:12 is not the charter for it, even though it is constantly used like that. A word in John 14:12 is works. It is erga in the Greek. It is exactly the same word as here in these letters to the churches. And as I wrote back to somebody who challenged me the other day, if you want to see what Jesus believes should be the greater works that the church is doing, read the seven letters to the churches in the beginning of Revelation. Here Jesus is looking at what the works should be. And they're works of faithfulness and evangelism and outreach for him. There are two lovely things, therefore, that Jesus picks out of this church in Philadelphia. Do look at them with me. Firstly, to use the opportunities for the gospel. You see, immediately in verse 8, we have the same words as we had in verse 7. I know your works. Behold, I have set before you an open door which no one is able to shut. I know that you have but little power, yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. Now, I pondered this letter. Certainly, at first sight, it's quite a difficult letter, isn't it? And I believe that the reason that this is repeated from verse 7 to verse 8, verse 7 makes us look at Jesus. Verse 8 is bringing it into the local situation. And I believe as you ponder this, it is an encouragement to the church that they see and understand and are proving that in spite of their being a small church in the midst of a very difficult situation, God is opening doors for evangelism and for the outreach of the gospel. And his thrill as the Lord of the church is that they are using those doors. Conversions presumably were happening. People were coming into the kingdom. What a joy that must be to Jesus. The Bible, as you know, says that over one sinner that repents, there's a party in heaven. Must be a lot of parties in heaven. A lot of celebration going on. Of one tonight. We want to pray for 10, 20, 30 people to come to Christ tonight. Not just to come tonight and make a profession of faith and then disappear, but people who will become the Lord's forever. The most marvelous opportunity that God has given us in this church for outreach. We still are staggering from the census statistic of the 140 people who declared themselves non-Christians on the day we did the census back in November last year. What an opportunity. Bless you. We love having lots and lots and lots of non-Christians in All Souls. And sitting and listening and sharing and challenging and going to Agnostics Anonymous and challenging out the faith. And many of us rejoicing in the large number of people that have come to Christ over this last year believe that possibly we're on the verge of much greater things this autumn. Many, many, I think, of this church family, many of us here have got a new verve in evangelism, a new desire to reach out for Jesus and to pray for people to come into the kingdom. Whatever the opportunities in Philadelphia were, I'm sure that ours are overwhelmingly more. People coming in off the street, following the crowd in, which happens most Sunday nights. People responding to the kingdom and to the gospel. The parish, yes, we find the parish tough. A large, multinational parish, difficult in a sense in evangelism, all sorts of problems that often dishearten some who undertake the work of visiting. But the parish is there. And again, we believe that one of the keys to parish evangelism is our open clubhouse in Cleveland Street, and why we believe it is right, even though the outside of our portico may fall down in the process, that we put our money there over the next 2 years for the sake of evangelism in this part of London. Thank God for the opportunities he gives us in so many different ways, opportunities for the gospel. Well, they used the opportunities. I wonder what they were in Philadelphia. One hesitates to guess. But possibly the very reasons that Attalus had originally founded the city were reasons that the Christians could take up, that a lot of people were coming in and going out. Perhaps they started a Christian coffee bar at the quayside. Never know. Or what better opportunity than a number of Christians to move in around the quayside and run bed and breakfast places for the sake of the gospel. That may sound far-fetched, but that would be a strategic form of evangelism with people coming through. It would be marvellous if we had 50 bed and breakfast homes here, each witnessing for Jesus. Difficult to make it known in a city like this, but easier in Philadelphia. But did they use the opportunities of people coming in and going out? Visitors here this morning, just tune off for a moment. Members of the church sometimes groan, don't you, about the number of visitors. You're not listening, are you, visitors? And say, every week I seem to be sitting next to somebody else. Now let me say to members of the church, is that a problem or an opportunity? And if you saw the letters that come in from people all across the world who've been here even for one Sunday, and Christ has met with them, they've been befriended by another Christian here, and they've gone back revolutionized for Jesus, you'll realize that God has given us an opportunity. Visitors, tune back. We love you. And we hope not only do you bring your own joy in sharing with us, but you'll take something of our fellowship and love as you go forward. So God has set before us here an open door. Oh, how he has. What a door. In fact, so many doors, we don't know which one to run through first. Thank God, it's a marvelous moment of opportunity for Jesus in London. And we want every Christian on the job. No room for passengers. What's the other thing that he commends them for? He commends them in verse 8 for faithfully enduring for him. Verse 8, you have kept my word and have not denied my name. Verse 10, you have kept my word of patient endurance. Here's a lovely thing. This church has been undergoing persecution. The tense of the Greek here implies that it had been a very specific, severe time of persecution. They'd just come through it. They'd come through it triumphantly, not denying Jesus, holding on to his truth. Even though, as verse 9 implies, the attack of the Jews was satanic. Notice how, in fact, Jesus says they're not really Jews because the people of God are now all those who belong to Jesus. But endurance is a quality which Jesus commends in the church, and it's highly commended in the New Testament. Mark 13, you remember, Jesus says, he who endures to the end will be saved. And the context, severe persecution and the second coming. Romans 5:3, speaking about the benefits of the gospel. Justified by faith, great. Access into his grace in which we stand, marvelous. Hope of the glory, tremendous. Then we often stop there, but it goes on. More than that, we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance. There it is again. And endurance produces character, and character produces hope. This is part of Christian growth. The Christians who seem to want a Christianity that doesn't have any of the problems and sufferings just miss out a whole chunk of the New Testament. Or again, write in 1 Corinthians 13 about love. Love endures all things. It's the same word. It's a quality that Jesus wants to see in his people and in his church. It's like the dependability we were thinking about in John last Sunday evening. It's that faithfulness that goes on with Jesus. It's great being in the youth fellowship in our local church. All the joy and the fun and the outings and the rambles and the coffee bar and all the rest of it. Suddenly we come up to London. We're thrown into a nurse's hostel. We feel the oppression of this great city. The loneliness comes in upon us. Now where's your faith? Jesus says, come on, now this is the moment really to prove your mind. The loneliness of our first job away from home. Persecution from people at our work, which is a very real thing in many people's lives or in their homes. Disappointment or sorrows as well as our joys. Sufferings as well as our health. Frustrations as well as our success. Old age as well as our youth. Is this an arena where your love for Jesus stands the test in sickness and in health? It's this which is Jesus is commending, a dogged, determined, loving faithfulness to Jesus that endures whatever is thrown at it. The quality of consistent, persistent, triumphant living that uplifts Jesus. And it's much more than a seven-day spectacular. Well, finally,
And very briefly, he shows them what lies ahead. Just look at it together. It's always a great encouragement to see what lies ahead. We were out doing the chaplaincy in Zermatt this summer and did various walks. One of them is, if you've been to Zermatt, you'll know the little Edelweiss cafe that hangs on a rock above Zermatt. Looks a jolly long way up. My Andrew encouraged me to go up to it with him. He's a bit younger than I am, so he didn't notice it quite as much as I did. And I struggled and puffed and climbed, and we eventually got nearer and nearer. But the great thing was that almost at every bend of the path you could look up. It still seemed a long way away, but it was there. And eventually we got there. The magnificent view, a lovely tea, a lovely piece of chocolate cake. It was marvellous. And how often in the midst of the fight for Jesus our eyes need to go up and up and up to all that Jesus has prepared for those who love him. It's the perspective he wants us to have. Just look at it very, very rapidly. There are four things. Verse 9, the amazing turnabout that's going to happen. Those who persecute the church of Jesus will come to bow down. That is, to the church of Jesus, to Jesus. The Jews expected Gentiles to bow down to them, but Jesus says no. Everybody's going to come and bow to Jesus. Or again, verse 10, his keeping power in the trial that's coming on the world. Interestingly, there was a very practical turn of that for Philadelphia. The Turk and Mohammedan flood swept all before it, except in Philadelphia. And it went on as a free Greek Christian city for centuries later in the midst of a pagan empire. Archbishop Trench many years ago says, it's a pleasing example that the paths of honour and safety may sometimes be the same. But I think it's also a picture to us of his keeping power. Many Christians are afraid, as other human beings, of what lies ahead in the world. But remember that whatever happens, you are kept in his hand. And nothing can take you from him. The promise is to all of us. How well that was portrayed with the Colemans and Gene Waddell in Waddell in their imprisonment in Iran. Incidentally, the Colemans are coming, we'll see on the sermon card in December. And thirdly, I am coming soon, the second coming, and all the incentive and encouragement that is. And then, fourthly, the security of verse 12. Philadelphia was a very insecure city, constant earthquakes. You often slept in the street in Philadelphia. So Jesus says, you're going to be a pillar, permanence, the name of God on you, you're going to belong to him, you're going to have a city, citizens of heaven, the great security of all that he's prepared for those who love him. Keep your eyes up to more than the Edelweiss Cafe, to all that Christ has prepared, and keep on for him. So you see, it's a letter of enormous encouragement, isn't it? As to who Jesus is, is he that to you this morning? Is he honestly your God and Lord? The true one, the only way to heaven, the holder of the keys? Is he someone who would encourage this church this morning in the way we use opportunities in our endurance for Jesus? Are we really alert as a Christian church? I thank God that many, many are. Thank you for all your alertness on a Sunday and through the week for Jesus. But honestly, some of us in this church family seem to be blind, deaf, and dumb as far as alertness for Jesus is concerned on a Sunday. God wake you up if you're like that. And as to what is going to happen, all other cares and ambitions and concerns fade, don't they, before this one great and tremendous objective for every believer of all that lies ahead. Jesus wanted to encourage the church in Philadelphia. May you and I be encouraged this morning.